Well, what a week it has been. What a tournament. And our thoughts turn inevitably to the retrospective after a feast of prime ministerial sport. It has, of course, been the Rest is History Prime Ministerial World Cup. And Tom Holland and I, Dominic Sambrook, we're still reeling in shock, I think, from some of those results, aren't we, Tom?
So much to talk about. So many matches that I think will live long in the memory. And I thought fascinating, not just for the kind of individual matches, but for the light that it shone on the whole field of prime ministerial sport, the reputations.
Are we going to do the whole podcast like this? Are we going to? Well, the Saint and Greavesy of history?
Well, Dominic, okay, well, that depends, doesn't it, Dominic? Because that depends on whether you think that organising British prime ministers into a fake World Cup and then having people vote on them on Twitter is the best way to evaluate their reputations. Do you think it is?
Well, it's a way. Well, you're never comparing like with like, are you? I mean, you're never comparing like with like anyway. So I don't think it's, of course, it's a ludicrous exercise, but arguably it's no more ludicrous than all the other exercises that are done comparing, you know, to Robert Walpole and Clement Attlee or whatever. So you know what? It was fun. I thought it was fun, and it was revealing about a particular demographic, i.e. our listeners, and what they think of our prime ministerial history. So I did learn. I actually did learn from it. Didn't you?
Okay. Yeah, I did. And for the benefit of those who aren't on Twitter and aren't aware of what we're talking about, which may well be a sizable number of people who are listening to this, we organised a tournament, a kind of knockout tournament. We had best of 16, quarterfinal, semifinals, final, to find out who the most popular British Prime Minister was, the Prime Minister that people who listen to this podcast and who follow it on Twitter chose as the greatest British Prime Minister. And Dominic, you selected the 16 prime ministers, didn't you?
Yes.
And you seeded them. So we had 8 seeds who were they? It was Churchill was the top seed, I think.
So it's Churchill, Walpole, Disraeli, Gladstone, Pitt the Younger, Attlee, Lloyd George, and Thatcher.
Right. So they were the 8, and then the other 8 were.
And the other 8 were Lord Salisbury, Tony Blair, Viscount Palmerston, Pitt the Elder. So Pitt the Younger was seeded, but Pitt the Elder not. Lord Liverpool, H.H. Asquith, Sir Robert Peel, and Harold Wilson, who was inserted at the last minute at the producer's request because the producer thought there were insufficient Labour names in the 16, and he wanted an extra person. Of course, Wilson got knocked out of the first hurdle. So that proves what Tony knows about history. And since he's not here for this recording, there's nothing he can do about it.
were there any prime ministers you felt were unlucky not to make that 16?
Well, I think I would have put Stanley Baldwin in, but that's because I'm a bit biased because I like Stanley Baldwin. I think when I look at our list and I look at the tournament, I think it's very modern heavy. So I think the 18th century looks like a huge black hole, doesn't it? And we didn't have anybody between. I mean, we had Pitt the Elder, but
and Walpole. After,
and Walpole. But, you know, there's all these names, sort of the Duke of Newcastle or something, the Earl of Bute. but basically like, nobody knows anything about. And we didn't, you know, there's a big hole.
It's like the lists of kind of 100 great albums, isn't it? And it's always the most recent albums that kind
yes,
of pop
exactly,
up.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
Possibly Sergeant Pepper lurking around at number 3 or something.
Although, Tom, my expectation, which was Thatcher and Blair would do very well for precisely that reason, as they do well in polls nationally, was not borne out. And I think that's an interesting example of the difference between political enthusiasts or history enthusiasts and the general public. Because while we were doing this, I was moved to look up the most recent survey. Have you seen this? The most recent national poll done by YouGov in 2019, where they asked people to who was the best prime minister. Now, who do you think people chose? The majority Churchill. Of the population. Churchill. 21%, I think, chose Churchill. Number 2?
I've no idea. I don't know.
Thatcher. 19%.
Really?
And then everybody else, I mean, literally everybody else was nowhere. Everybody else was kind of 4%, 5%. I think Tony Blair was 5%. Attlee was 4% or something like that. And, you know, everything. And that just shows how there's a difference between the public and our listeners, actually.
Or are you perhaps implying that people on left wing are people on Twitter are more left wing than people who aren't?
Well, that's
a shocking thought.
Yeah, I mean, that will horrify some of our listeners, perhaps. But of course, that's well chronicled, isn't it? That Twitter tends to skew to the left, and I think you saw that a little bit in this in our exercise.
Okay, so it's a bit like England playing in Mexico, that it's harder for certain players to compete on Twitter.
I think there are definitely one or two players. I can think of one player in particular. I think if you put Margaret Thatcher on a Twitter poll against anybody, animal, vegetable, or mineral, she's going to lose.
Yeah. Bona Law. Yes. Lord North. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, should we look at the group matches and just do it to essentially, we're not going to discuss the ins and outs of the match. We're just going to talk about the contenders and how they shape up.
Sure.
So the first round was Disraeli against Lord Salisbury, and Disraeli won that. He got 79% of the vote. So Disraeli, we had a bit of a difference on that, because I wanted him as a seed and you didn't, and I think that was the only thing that you seeded to me was letting Disraeli get in.
Well, here you've got a really good example, I think, Tom, of the way we think about prime ministers in history. So, I mean, we've done tons of podcasts where we've talked about great men or greatness and individuals in history. But prime ministers are an interesting one, because there's always a slight difference between, you know, the historical record and what historians think of them and their place in the public memory. So Disraeli, I think there is a big difference between, you know, he wasn't prime minister that long. He wasn't astoundingly popular at the time by any means, but he's left this enormous imprint on the popular imagination as a sort of Victorian prime minister, you know, as a sort of dandy, as the face of imperialism, as the face of kind of popular Toryism.
And Queen Victoria loved him.
And Queen Victoria loved him. And the sort of Gladstone-Disraeli rivalry. And Disraeli props up, and, you know, we see him in films. Sort of somebody like Anthony Scher is always playing him in films about Queen Victoria. And it's all very jolly and everybody's pleased to see him. You know, there's Disraeli. But Lord Salisbury was a much more substantial figure. He was prime minister for longer. He presided over, you know, if you're going to pick a moment when Britain was really top nation, I think under Lord Salisbury probably would be it. And Lord Salisbury epitomised a particular kind of Toryism that's very successful, kind of villa Toryism at the end of the 19th century.
So the thing about Lord Salisbury, who is prime minister, three times, isn't he?
And
he's prime minister when the 19th century becomes the 20th century. So
exactly, he is. Yes.
He said my favourite ever prime ministerial saying, which is whatever happens will be for the worse, and therefore it is in our interest that as little should happen as possible. And I guess that's the people who don't like conservatives think that's the essence of conservatism, just stop anything changing. But that's not what he did, is it? I mean, because basically Salisbury does lay the foundations for the kind of 20th century incarnation of the Conservative Party, which actually has been much more successful than either the Liberals or Labour in the 20th century.
Yes. So Salisbury said a lot of reactionary things. He looked very reactionary. He kind of incarnated what he seemed
and
to incarnate.
He looked reactionary because he had a big beard.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
although,
basically, that's what
Corbyn
I'm saying.
Had Corbyn become Prime Minister, then he would have been...
His beard was smaller. I think no one can dispute that Corbyn...
But we've had no bearded Prime Minister since Lord Salisbury, so Corbyn not becoming Prime Minister was a wasted opportunity on the pognophile front.
Salisbury's also the first Prime Minister to have electricity. So he's got his house fully kitted out with electric lights, well ahead of almost, you know, most of his contemporaries.
And when you say his house...
Well, his house colossal. Yeah, it's colossal. But Salisbury, well, I mean... It's obviously ludicrous to make a case for Lord Salisbury, because he's dead in terms of public opinion. Nobody really remembers Lord Salisbury other than historians and historical enthusiasts. But he's a much more substantial figure, I would argue,
than
Disraeli.
But I guess that kind of points out that part of what people are voting for in this is it's not just political achievements. It's the kind of the charge that you leave in the historical imagination.
Exactly.
And Disraeli is a wit. He's a novelist. He's flamboyant. And he's a contrast to Gladstonian Victorian moralism.
Exactly.
I mean, he's kind of Dickens, isn't he? Dickens who's become Prime Minister.
Yeah, he's the way station between Dickens and Lloyd George. So, and he also, Disraeli is the first. So there's a huge tradition in Britain, I think, of the mountebank prime minister. And we have one now. Yes, you know, the British the British vote electorate loves a mountebank. And I think mountebank is the word. And Disraeli was a mountebank. Lloyd George was a mountebank. Tony Blair was a bit of a mountebank. And Boris Johnson is a mountebank.
Definitely is. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, I think that this is kind of interesting as a reminder that the impression that people leave on the historical record is it extends beyond the academic texts that professional
historians study. Absolutely. I mean, you get this with Roman emperors, don't you, Tom?
Yeah,
I mean,
and that's a crucial part of it. Yeah, yeah. Well, we've talked about Disraeli. Inevitably, we now come on to Gladstone, who was drawn very amusingly against Tony Blair. And Gladstone won 55%. So that was quite a tough battle, actually.
Before we talk about Gladstone specifically, I think maybe we should leave Gladstone slightly later on because he becomes a big star later in the tournament, doesn't he?
Okay, so let's talk about
Tony Blair. It's Blair bowing out that I think is so interesting. And I think Blair on Twitter is always going to face a big uphill battle because, as you say, Twitter kind of leans to the left and Blair is crippled by Iraq. But I think what's fascinating about Tony Blair as a prime ministerial character is he won three elections. He was obviously tremendously popular and tremendously effective as an electoral vote winner. But I can't think of many prime ministers whose reputation has sunk so precipitously after leaving office. You know, so Tony Blair is now the one prime minister who basically, you know, he shows his face in public. He goes to buy some milk at the corner shop and people shout at him about Iraq and say, oh, you ran off to America or you're a fraud and all that sort of thing.
Well, but isn't it also crucially, he wouldn't go and buy milk from a corner shop because he's so rich. And that's another aspect of it.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, but prime ministers are often rich when they leave office. I mean, Margaret Thatcher made a lot of money from speeches. But with Blair,
but
there was something...
you'd expect her to because you know, she was all about making money. I mean, that was what it was all about. Whereas Tony Blair was, you know, I mean, he was supposedly a socialist. He just kind of made it. And people never like socialists making money, I think.
No, and I suppose, I just think it's an extraordinary, you know, one day someone will do an extraordinary biography of Tony Blair and it will seem like this sort of Greek tragedy. The trajectory from the 1997, things can only get better, people waving their little Union Jacks outside number 10, to the sort of sense now that he's actually become, for a lot of people, I think almost a comic figure.
Not for me, Dominic.
Well, I know
I have to listen to him and I think, yeah, that's completely, what good sense?
But you see, you admire him for all the wrong reasons, though, don't you?
I think he was the person who was behind the idea that the second vaccine should be delayed, which then got picked up by the government and became...
He was single-handedly responsible for that, you think, Tom?
I think he was the political figure who was pushing for that the hardest and then got taken up. So I think he's still out there doing good. Anyway, Blair got knocked out.
That then set up
the intriguing quarterfinal round between Disraeli and Gladstone. I mean, absolutely one for the fans. That's what the tournament wanted and needed and got. So we'll come to that in due course. But the next group match was Winston Churchill, top seed. So we'll perhaps come on to Churchill later. He won by 62% against Viscount Palmerston. I think my favourite Victorian Prime Minister. So he's Prime Minister 1855-8, 1859-65. He's a tremendous lad, isn't he?
I think, yes. I think Palmerston would... I'm surprised he hasn't... I guess it's a sign that he's not better known, that he hasn't been totally cancelled. Because in the age of Me Too, I don't think he's a very... You know, he's not... You wouldn't go to, you know, you wouldn't die in a ditch for Viscount Palmerston's reputation, would you? He's the kind of guy who he goes to stay with Queen Victoria and he bothers her maids and, you know, can't keep his hands to himself. I mean, that's one thing.
Well, supposedly, wasn't that because he went into the room thinking that it was someone who he'd been, it was a usual bedroom who would welcome him?
Yes, who would welcome
him. I think there was some control. I agree. It doesn't look entirely good from today's perspective. But he did make one of the all-time great prime ministerial jokes to the French guy who said that if I were not a Frenchman, I would wish to be an Englishman, to which Palmerston wittily replied, if I were not an Englishman, I would wish to be an Englishman too.
That's very good. But of course, he is the... Palmerston, again, you got the slight gap between the historical record and the public image. And insofar as Palmerston has a public image, it is the swashbuckling, sort of aged but swashbuckling exponent of gumboat diplomacy.
Yes, because he's 70 when he becomes Prime Minister. So he's the oldest person to become Prime Minister.
And basically, Palmerston's thing, you know, the sort of Don Pacifico affair and all these sort of, is that if somebody has even the slightest connection to Britain, the most tenuous claim to citizenship, and, you know, their face is slapped in a bar in some sort of fly-bitten port, Palmerston will send a gunboat to blast
the fly and strong arm of England. Yeah, so he's the kind of the embodiment of Victorian gunboat.
Absolutely,
self-confidence in the middle of the 19th century. So it's not really surprising he lost.
No, I mean, this wasn't his year. I think we can safely say this.
this isn't his moment. Okay, and talking of flamboyant imperial expansion, the next group round again. I mean, this was a classic one for the. I mean, the crowds loved this. It's again what they wanted. Pitt the Younger against Pitt the Elder. So son against father. Pitt the Younger won that 75%. So Dominic, so Pitt the Elder, Pitt the Younger, tell us about them because people may not know about them.
Right. So Pitt the Elder is, he becomes Lord Chatham. He is sort of mid to late 18th century. Pitt the Elder is, I don't actually know much about Pitt the Elder, Tom. I was going to try and bluff it, and then I thought, I know his Trump's printed out a load of stuff, and he's got to come prepared, so I'll let you do it.
Well, Pitt the Elder, I was actually backing. He was my favourite. He was the guy I wanted to win, because he was MP for Old Sarum, which was one of the boroughs.
Salisbury.
I think they had kind of five voters and about 50 sheep. And he dominated the House of Commons.
Is that all you know about the sheep?
That's all. No, but he's basically not as prime minister, but he's the guy who's essentially behind Britain's success in the Seven Years' War.
And we're going to be exactly. That's
a podcast with Dan Snow about the Seven Years' War in due course. But he essentially is the guy who makes Britain a global imperial power. So again, you might well say that this year is not perhaps his year.
He has a great line: "I know that I alone can save the country, and no one else can," or something like that, which Margaret Thatcher quotes in her memoirs, saying she thought of Pitt the Elder when she became prime minister. And then Pitt the Younger, I mean, Pitt the Younger is one of those relatively few figures, I think, who is just a genuine colossus. So I think Pitt the, you know, if I was picking semi-finalists purely on performance, I think Pitt the Younger would have, as indeed he was, would be a semi-finalist, because he comes in at the end of the 18th century. He's, what is he, 24 when he becomes prime minister?
24, and he's got young legs. So we've had Palmerston's the oldest.
Yes.
Pitt the Younger is the youngest.
And Pitt is, he's seen as the incarnation of anti-corruption after what's been a pretty corrupt period in British politics, really going back to Walpole. He is modern. He creates a series of coalitions to fight Napoleon. He's very anti-Jacobin, anti-French Revolution, sort of patriotic.
Yeah, he is, and he's the guy behind, you know, who essentially kind of inspires Britain to fight against France through the revolutionary period, through the Napoleonic period, dies shortly after the battles of Trafalgar and Austerlitz. But he is a very committed abolitionist. So I think that this is quite an important aspect of how prime ministers are seen at the moment, is where they stood on issues of the empire and on slavery.
So because this came up again and again on Twitter comments, didn't
again
it?
And again. Yeah. So Pitt the Elder is definitely, I mean, he's Mr. British Empire guy, and Pitt the Younger obviously holds it together by keeping Britain free from French invasion. But he is definitely on the side of angels when it comes to slavery. He's a friend of Wilberforce, big opponent of abolitionism. So perhaps that explains why, you know, that might be a part of why he went as far as he did.
In the Wilberforce biopic, he's played by Benedict Cumberbatch. I don't know if you've seen it. Amazing Grace. He's played by Benedict Cumberbatch. And actually, that's one of the few times, I mean, Pitt the Younger was mocked in Blackadder. But Pitt the Younger, I mean, both Pitts have left very little mark on the kind of cultural imagination, haven't they? I mean, most, you stop 100 people in the street in Sunderland, and how many of them can tell you about either of the Pitts? So, you know, they should loom larger than they do. And it, to me, it was a slight surprise, actually, that Pitt the Younger got as far as he did in the tournament. I mean, maybe it's an anti-French vote to some extent. People sort of said, he won wars, hurrah, hurrah. He's sort of basking in a bit of Nelson's reflected glory, I suspect.
He also was famously prescribed port by his doctor and then became addicted to it. And apparently, I learned yesterday, somebody on Twitter told me that the doctor who prescribed the port to him that his son then succeeded Pitt as Prime Minister.
So Lord Ornington,
was obviously playing the long game there. So,
yes.
So maybe he'll feature in next year's World Cup. Who knows?
All right. Well, we've done four of the first round matches. Coming up after the break, we have the eventual champion, and we have some absolute titans of the game, Tom. Lloyd George, Walpole, Asquith, and of course, Margaret Thatcher. So join us after the break for these colossal contenders. Welcome back to The Rest is History, and we are, of course, talking about the Prime Minister's World Cup. Is the eventual winner on this side of the draw? Well, time will tell. Let's start with this glamour tie, Tom Holland. Clement Attlee versus Liverpool, Lord Liverpool. Who did you fancy from the beginning in this one?
I went for Clement Attlee, who I thought was going to win and indeed did win by the thumping margin of 81%. I mean, that was the largest margin of victory. And I think that's probably because most people have no idea who Lord Liverpool is.
Yes. So
including
me, really...
because I rather embarrassingly thought that he was Prime Minister during the Crimean War, which was, of course, Aberdeen.
Yeah. You basically got your cities mixed up, didn't you?
I did.
So Lord Liverpool is this sort of ultra-reactionary figure, really. He's the end of the Napoleonic Wars and into the 1820s. He's Prime Minister a ridiculously long time.
And he's Mr. Peterloo, isn't he? So that wouldn't make him popular with people on Twitter at all.
No, I kind of, now that I look at that, I wonder whether we included him in the seeds purely on the basis of longevity rather than any reasonable prospect of victory.
Didn't you say that he was the first Prime Minister to wear trousers?
He was. He was the first Prime Minister to wear trousers.
I think that's reasonable. And also, he's the only Prime Minister to have a London railway station named after him. Liverpool Street.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's a very good fact. Yes, I've never... Because, of course, Liverpool Street, you can't go to Liverpool from Liverpool Street.
No, it's named after Lord Liverpool.
Yeah. And obviously, Peterloo. So he's one of these people, in the long run, people will only ever know one thing about him. And that will be Peterloo.
So we should just say, I realise that we haven't said, he was Prime Minister 1812 to 1827. I mean, that's a long
stretch. Such a long time. Such a long stretch. But obviously in a slightly pre-democratic era, he's head of this sort of relatively aristocratic cabal that's running the country, and he just sticks at it.
The argument in his favour
is stability, I suppose.
It's interesting that... his government is wildly unpopular with a lot of very famous poets, so Byron, Shelley, and so on, who react very, very, very strongly against Peterloo and all that. But they never actually target Liverpool; they're always going after Castlereagh, who's Foreign Secretary at the time. And
I think it's slightly colourless. Lord Liverpool is one of these prime ministers who's slightly colourless. Yeah. I mean, actually, in that sense, the Attlee matchup is not such a bad matchup because they both are less well known in some ways than some of the characters in their governments.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's great punditry there. I like that. Really like that. That's really good.
You think I've got a career in this kind of thing?
And talking of punditry, we now move on to definitely one of the kind of star performers in the tournament who didn't go beyond this round, and that was Margaret Thatcher, who was one of the seeds.
She was up against Herbert Henry Asquith, who was Prime Minister from 1908 to 1916,
And who led us into the First World War.
So Asquith, I love Asquith. He's a great figure. I'm very fond of Asquith. He won pretty comfortably, actually, 59%, beating Thatcher. And our producer had said to me when this started, if Thatcher wins, you're going to have to write your own scripts. That suggests that he always writes the scripts, which, of course, that's a bit of a kind of a moot point. She was never in danger of winning the tournament, was she? I mean, she was never going to win a tournament like this. And it's an interesting thing with Margaret Thatcher. It's not just that she's divisive, because I think to be a politician, by definition, is to be divisive, because to govern is to choose. And, it's the fact that the divisiveness has lingered so long and now defines her for a lot of people. And there are a few other prime ministers of whom that's true, I think. And it's extraordinary. And I think a lot of that, Tom.
Perhaps Blair?
Possibly, but I think it's more charged with Thatcher. I think it's much more charged. And I think, personally, I think a lot of it is because she's a woman. And I think I've always thought that a lot of it is very charged because she's a woman and because she's seen as a woman who closed down a particular masculine way of life. And I think that adds a lot of the charge to it.
Because Theresa May isn't regarded with any... I mean, people barely remember her at all, do they?
No, people don't really remember. I mean, already you can sort of say Theresa, you know that Theresa May will be a bit of a footnote in history, as Gordon Brown is, actually, or as James Callaghan is, or Sir Alec Douglas Hume. You know, there are some prime ministers, you know, Ted Heath was only prime minister for 3.5 years, but he did a lot, and he was Mr. Europe. You know, Europe was his thing, and that defined him. What's going to define Mrs. May? I mean, failing to get Brexit.
So Mrs. Thatcher lost. Asquith, of course, a Balliol man like yourself.
Yeah, like myself.
The superiority of a Balliol man. So, were you backing him? I guess
I wanted him to. Well, I do like to see Asquith going far because I think he was utterly shafted by Lloyd George in the First World War, and of course Asquith is this fantastic character. You know, he's basically, when the First World War breaks out, he's busy bothering his daughter's best friend, Venetia Stanley, and sending her these endless letters. In fact, there's a hilarious moment about a week before the First World War breaks out. He writes to Venetia Stanley, who's basically, what is she, about 25 years his junior or something, and says, "This is the most awful torment I've ever known. I have to give up coming to see you at Country House weekend because I've got to deal with this bloody
blasted First World War."
And there's a lot of this sort of stuff is, you know, during one of the battles of the Western Front, he's spotted reading a book in the Athenaeum while having his hair cut. And there's all this sort of misbehavior.
Bonar Law, the Conservative leader, when they went into coalition, went round to talk to Asquith, and he was kind of playing bridge with three young ladies. Yeah, and that's kind of what I mean, you wouldn't think that this is the guy to beat a heavyweight champion like Thatcher, but clearly
he did. Yeah, clearly picnicking, reading classic books and having your hair cut during battles is obviously the way to go.
But I quite like the idea that somebody who sits around reading classic books beat someone who never did. Anyway, let's move on. So the next match was Sir Robert Walpole, the first Prime Minister, against Peel. And Walpole won that 64%.
No, he didn't. He lost it. Peel won.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Sorry, Peel won. Yeah, Peel won. So Walpole was seeded. And I guess that you seeded him because he's the first Prime Minister. So he's the beginning of the 18th century. Obviously a titanic figure, but I guess that perhaps people remember Peel better than they remember Walpole.
I mean, I think people remember Peel. Some people have done Peel at school. They've done the Corn Laws, the repeal of the Corn Laws. So basically when Peel, the Corn Laws were a hugely sort of beloved pillar of Tory ideology, protecting domestic farmers and keeping prices of food high. And Peel repeals the Corn Laws, basically committing political suicide because he thinks that people in the cities should get cheap food from abroad.
And also this is against the backdrop of the famine in Ireland as well, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, the other thing he's remembered for is the police. So Bobbies. You know, the Metropolitan Police. So Peel has two big things sort of in his favour that people remember. Now, Walpole, to me, Walpole should be a semi-finalist. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that Walpole is in the top four because he founded the office of Prime Minister. At the beginning of the kind of Hanoverian succession, Walpole establishes stability. He's Prime Minister for 21 years.
But he's a massive crook, isn't he?
He is a crook, but I mean, who isn't a crook in 18th century politics? I mean, that's just a sort of ludicrous allegation.
No, it isn't, because even by the standards of the early 18th century, he's regarded as a crook.
But I think there's much. I mean, he keeps us out of lots of foreign wars. He has, you know, Britain is extremely stable, you know, by comparison to what's come before. I mean, you think what's come, if you're becoming Prime Minister in 1721, it's a new office, you've just got this German monarch over. It's against
to whom you're
backdrop.
Speaking in Latin.
Yes, extraordinary. Yeah. And against the backdrop of in pretty much in living memory, you've had a revolution, the Glorious Revolution, one king being kicked out. You have the Civil War lurking behind all that, and you have the rise of, you know, France as the great superpower and all this. And Walpole presides over this sort of this golden age in some ways for the new United Kingdom. You know, it's in Great Britain is a new country formed in 1707. And all of that is a tremendous achievement. And sure, he lined his pockets, but they all did. And, you know, I think he should be in the top. I think he should be two or three, to be honest, in British Prime
Ministers. He's portrayed as Harriman in The Beggar's Opera. And he's so cross about that he then brings in the Lord Chamberlain censoring plays.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I'm quite authoritarian, as you know, so.
I don't know.
He enshrines Whiggishness as the absolute governing creed of 18th century Britain. And he defines British politics in the 18th century.
He had beautiful porcelain, and I've seen his porcelain. Do you know where I saw it?
Have you? Do you know where it is? I can't possibly imagine.
It's in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg.
It's Robert Walpole's.
Yeah, so he had an amazing art collection in Houghton Hall in Norfolk. And then it all got sold to Catherine the Great.
That's a very interesting fact.
Very interesting. And I think it went back to Houghton Hall a couple of years ago. And I spent all the time it was there, I was thinking, I must go and see it. And then I completely forgot to go and see it. So an opportunity wasted. But I had seen it in the Hermitage. So that was
what a great story there from TV somewhere.
Punditry. We've got punditry.
Robert Peel had a Staffordshire accent. That's another good fact.
Yeah, well, he's from Tamworth.
So Peel is one of the last prime ministers, really, for a very long time, to have a non-RP accent. And there's a point at which, obviously, all prime ministers after that are going to public school and they're all speaking the same way. But he's got a regional accent.
Peel went to Harrow, where he was friends with Byron.
Yeah, but obviously he kept
obviously he didn't pick it up. And then he gives the Tamworth Manifesto, doesn't he? Which is the first political manifesto in British history.
So somebody, we're talking about Gladstone earlier, and we'll come back to Gladstone in another podcast, but somebody was sharing a clip online. There's a recording of Gladstone speaking, and there's this claim that Gladstone spoke with a Liverpool accent, and he doesn't. He sounds nothing like, Ricky Tomlin's.
Imagine no possessions.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that's Walpole and Peel. And then the final one was Lloyd George against Harold Wilson. You've already been read about Harold Wilson and given away the result. George won that 60%. Maybe come to Lloyd George when we talk about the quarterfinals. But
Let's do Wilson.
Let's do Wilson.
So some people love Wilson, don't they? Some people love Wilson. I mean, I've written a lot about Harold Wilson. You know, I've basically written hundreds of thousands of words about Harold Wilson. And I always think he would be a great person to have as your next door neighbour. You know,
why is that?
He's a nice guy. He'd lend you his lawnmower.
His
good company. You know, you could go around and he'd get out the brandy bottle. He has a great knowledge. He'd be great on this podcast, actually, because he had a great knowledge of minutiae. He and Roy Jenkins, when Roy Jenkins was a chancellor, they bonded over their knowledge of railway timetables, for which they were both enthusiasts.
He was very young, wasn't he, when he became... He was about 10 or something when he became
president of the Board of Trade.
That's right. Yeah.
And he had this terrible moustache, which he grew in the 1940s to make himself appear more mature. He had got supposedly the best degree in economics or something, the best mark in economics that Oxford had ever seen when he was a... And he was at Oxford in the 30s. I think it's the 30s, at a time when, you know, everybody else was going to sort of communist meetings and cocktail parties. And Wilson was asked to go to one of these. And he said, "Oh, no, thank you very much. I came here to work." And basically.
Man after your own heart.
And all the, yes, exactly. And all his sort of, a lot of his Labour colleagues actually looked down on him because they saw him as too middle brow. He read Agatha Christie. He played golf. He ate tin salmon rather than smoked. He had these sort of very humdrum habits, which, of course, endeared him hugely to ordinary voters because people saw in Wilson somebody like themselves. I always think Wilson is a great model for the Labour Party. You know, if you pick somebody like Wilson, I mean, he's not that dissimilar from Attlee. Sort of small C conservative, patriotic, ordinary. He makes a virtue of his own ordinariness And he goes out of his way to say it's the Tories who are extraordinary because they're rich and spoiled. And I'm just like you. I'm not, you know, he didn't make a great point of ideology. So when he commissioned Philip Ziegler, the biographer of Mountbatten, to be his authorized biographer, Ziegler said to him, you know, I'd love to do it, but there's one problem. I'm not a socialist. And Wilson said, oh, don't worry, neither am I. And that sort of thing, it's basically a lot of his own activists held against him. I think that kind of thing endeared him to ordinary voters.
Okay, I've got a question for you, which is flagging up a podcast we're going to do on, we're going out on Thursday with Ben McIntyre about the history of espionage and spying.
Yeah.
Wilson thought that he was being bugged by MI5, didn't he?
He did. It's really, really unclear. So Wilson does, in his second time in office, which is pretty shabby, and I would say is probably the worst period of prime ministerial leadership in our lifetimes, 74 to 76, he does seem to have got very, very paranoid. He thought he was being bugged by the South Africans, by BOSS, the South African spy agency. And he also thinks, you know, there's lots of stories.
The South African spy agency was called BOSS.
Yeah, unbelievably.
That's brilliant. I mean,
brilliant. Bureau of State Security, I think it is.
Goodness, I've learned something.
And so the stories, people like Shirley Williams tell these stories. They say he would take them into the sort of the dining room or the cabinet room, and he'd point to a picture of Gladstone, funnily enough, and he'd point to Gladstone and say, that portrait is bugged. They're watching me through Gladstone, or they're listening to me through Gladstone. Or he'd take people into the toilets and say, we can only talk here, and you put on the taps. All this sort of stuff. I mean, this genuinely happened. Now, some of his ministers thought this was demented. And
he had dementia, didn't he, while he was in office?
Well, it's unclear, perhaps. But possibly in the final months. Certainly his mind, his memory was not what it was. And he said as much to his aides, to Joe Haines and Bernard Donoghue, who his closest aides, he would say, I don't really have anything to say. I can't remember about this. You know, I'm not what I was. So it's possible. Were they systematically bugging him? I think not, but I think there were agents within it. I mean, MI5 was a pretty ramshackle, shabby arrangement. I mean, very Le Carre-like, actually, in the 70s. And there were people like Peter Wright, who wrote the book Spycatcher, who were kind of paranoid, you know, slightly Daily Express-ish, kind of. They thought, yeah, Wilson was a red, and they were kind of going around saying, I mean, when Ted Heath was asked about this, Ted Heath said, he said, basically, the people in MI5 are so mad that when they see somebody on the tube reading the Daily Mirror, they say, he must be a communist. We must have him followed. So clearly, across the political spectrum, there was a sense that MI5 was slightly out of control. So Wilson was probably on to something.
So MI5 will be pleased that Wilson was knocked out, losing,
yes,
60%, yeah, to Lloyd George. And I think that that wraps up the group matches.
Okay.
So we're left with the quarterfinals, which was
extraordinary drama in the quarterfinals.
So the quarterfinals are Peel against Pitt the Younger, Lloyd George against Attlee, Disraeli against Gladstone, Churchill against Asquith. We then had the semi-finals and then, of course, the final. And we will go through those various matches. We will look at the titans who were playing in those rounds. Close-up analysis, all the kind of sports punditry that you'd expect from someone like Dominic. And we will be putting that into a second Prime Ministerial World Cup podcast, which will be going out tomorrow. So that is it from us for now. We will follow through this thrilling sporting contest in tomorrow's podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.